Awani Review with me, Ibrahim Sani. Today is an interesting guest that I have. He is a professor of linguistics at the University of Malaya. His name is Dr. David Yong. Over the course of his education background, he is trying to decipher or uncode or decode the value of linguistics and how we imply and use it in our day-to-day interaction. Why I find it interesting today is because he has decoded one of my rather important interviews back when I was in BFM. 2 years ago, myself and another colleague of mine, Julian Ng, interviewed then CEO of 1MDB, Arul Kanda. Dr. David Yong has broken down the transcript of the interview and has provided his commentaries on that particular interview. In it, he presents a psychological aspect of that interview. He tries to understand better what makes a hostile interview hostile and the learnings from that interview, much of which I am trying to learn myself. Perhaps this would be one of the good opportunities for me to learn from him. Dr. David Yong, thank you very much. Let's understand what you do first.
Right, so I'm known as a discourse analyst. So what we do is we study text and talk, right? So it could be any kind of talk, like things that happen in the home setting. It could be how we interact with colleagues, how politicians speak, and stuff like that. So we look into text, we look into talk, anything that has communicative intent.
What was the main motivation of you trying to break down that interview on 1MDB with
right.
BFM?
So there are actually two answers to that, I would say. The first is, as a discourse analyst, I find all talk very fascinating. Now, if you were to ask me about my personal motivation, right, why I actually pursued this, I thought Arul Kanda is actually a very skilled person. You know, he was able to ninja or tai chi his way through the interview that you guys had with him in a very hostile, hard talk sort of genre of communication. So he was able to do that, and I pursued further. I wanted to know how did other people actually regard that interview. And there was actually a study that was done by Chili Sauce, right? So in Chili Sauce, they asked readers, you know, how did they perceive that interview that you had with Arul Kanda? And about 85% of them said that Arul Kanda was excellent. And you guys actually, you know, I don't mean to be rude or whatever, but you guys were grilled by Arul Kanda on the Brixus grill. So yeah, that was one of those things that actually got me very interested. Like, you know, how did he go about doing this? How did he interact? How did he manage impressions of culpability?
The level of interview that we do at BFM then, again, it was can be characterized as a hostile interview kind of show.
Yeah, right.
And I dare say 99% of my interview, I would believe at least that I come up tops, except for that one interview where there is a high level of contrition on my end that I do accept that he was a rather skillful interviewee,
right,
that I have ever come across. In fact, perhaps you know, the most skillful interviewee that I have to deal with
right.
in my career in broadcast journalism. What would be the two or three highlights that you believe, we can go into details,
sure.
but this is just the top line figures, the key highlights of what makes him a skillful interviewee?
First of all, I think he is very comfortable with the whole genre of hard talk. He is very competent, he is knowledgeable, and he has exhibited some degree of comfortability of actually being engaged in such hostile sort of interactions, right? And I think you can attribute that to his experience, you know, growing up, being a debater, having all sorts of portfolio. And I think he's also very well informed and well read. So all of this, you know, I would say knowledge is power. And when you have power, you're able to mold it in such ways that makes you a powerful figure. So that is one of those things that came across to me very strongly in the interaction. Second, I think he is actually quite familiar with all sorts of different specific knowledge. For example, when there was one segment right in the talk where Julian Ng actually said this, if you're not innocent, you're guilty, right? And he counters that by saying, no, you are innocent until proven guilty. So that was one example that shows how he was able to bring in different kinds of knowledge in law, the genre of law. So, you know, when we talk about knowledge, right, you have different kinds. You have like medical knowledge, legal knowledge, disciplinary knowledge, and so on and so forth. But to express all of this knowledge, you have different modes. You have the courtroom discourse, where, for example, in the legal discourse, you have the courtroom setting. That is a kind of genre by itself. Then you have the contract types of genres. So he is very competent in all of these different kinds of genres, different kinds of discourses, and he's able to pick and choose whichever to activate at any point in the interview.
Does this reflect high intelligence?
Yes, it does.
The conversation that we're going to go into is in-depth. Prior to this interview, you have emailed me your draft copy of that particular discourse or thesis that you've done on my interview, my Julian Ng as well, with Arukanda. Believe it or not, I have sort of like memorized much of that particular draft discourse because these are the things that I look forward to, not just as a personal development kind of career, but it's also trying to understand the intersection of your work with the other fields of knowledge that we have.
Right.
Prior to this interview, I was asking you, do you think that your work as a linguist intersect with psychology or any other human behaviors? And you say it does. How does that intersection happen?
Well, because language, the way we communicate with people, is always much influenced by so many variables, so many different kinds of factors. You have intelligence, you have your society, the culture you grew up in, you have things like, you know, your socioeconomic standing can all influence the way we interact with one another. So, for example, if you were to speak to a Datuk, a Tan Sri, you will tend, as a person who is not as powerful as them, and you would know it because once you start to interact, you tend to, I mean, a person who is very competent, right, in terms of being rational, we're talking about a normal person, when they get into this kind of settings, they tend to understand that this is the norm of the interaction. So you tend to follow what other people are playing and you try to blend in.
There is this, basically what I'm trying to do, if I can paraphrase, is that members of society, particularly those functioning ones, tend to know already the kind of power balance that happens.
It's more of being aware, that's one thing, and also learning that this is how we interact. For example, this is my first time being in this studio, right? But I am learning very quickly that this is what it means to be in my role as an interviewee. So, and this is what your role is as an interviewer. So, and also the cameraman, what his role is, right? So I'm picking all of this up, although this is my very first time being here. So I'm trying to accommodate to that sort of expectations. And that's what we all do in society. So we start to understand that this person is powerful because of maybe certain social cues, and then we start to accommodate. And we tend to also repair ourselves a lot. So that means if we think we have messed up in certain parts of our interaction, then we will quickly regulate.
Self-correct.
Yeah, we self-correct, we regulate ourselves so that we blend in into that sort of contextual situation.
Again, the big disclaimer here is that you have to be a functioning member of society.
That's
if
right.
you have some sort of deficiency, I don't know, anywhere from autism to maybe that kind of antisocial behavior, you might not be able to.
And also, if you come from a different culture, for example, right, and let's say you're visiting in a certain context, which is completely alien to you, you might be actually making a lot of mistakes in that interaction.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I was in Australia, I was not aware that, you know, there was one red button, you know, in the gas station. It was stated there, I recall this very, very clearly, press here, right? And I thought that button would actually open the door. And it was a red button, really big one. So I pressed that button, and you know what happened? The alarm went off, and the gas station just shut down.
Wow.
Yeah, because I was not aware that in that cultural context, that kind of red button next to the door is actually a way to stop that, you know, things from, you know, petrol from actually flowing and so on. So if you're not familiar with that sort of contextual, the social context, you tend to commit a lot of faux pas.
Okay.
So, but we are very quick because we are quite intelligent, quite an intelligent species. So we tend to understand very quickly, right, that this is taboo, this is something I should not be doing, and you start to regulate yourself and you accommodate so that, you know, Because we do that because we don't want to be punished by society.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the main question here. What motivates one to self-correct or self-regulate in a social setting? What is the main motivator?
We want to be like. All of us want to be like. We want to be accepted by society. And we don't want to be punished. So we tend to actually follow these rules of engagement in interaction. So that's what I study as a discourse analyst as well. I look at what are these interactional rules? What are the thresholds that cause these rules to be broken? And when and how do people react towards that? So for my PhD thesis, for example, I looked at the rules of engagement in parliament, Malaysian parliament, right? And I argued in my thesis that there's actually a continuum, a spectrum, where at one end you have things which are orderly, and on the other hand, very, very disorderly, and this disorderliness is not acceptable. And you have, of course, the interactions in between, which I would deem as acceptable forms of disorderliness. So examples, right? You go to parliament, you follow certain rules. For example, when someone, you want to take the floor, what do? You need to stand up. And then when you're picked, then you would say, Terima kasih yang berhormat, you would go, and you will never address the other person directly above you. So you will never have second person perspective. Sorry, what's that term? Second person pronouns. You will never use you, awa, anda in parliament, right? But there are instances where these are done. And when they are done, they can be classified as a kind of disorderliness, but to what degree is it acceptable or unacceptable? Mm. So that's what I do as well. I look into the thresholds.
The context of it is also important. Does your work only involve English or any other languages?
No, we are actually very much language neutral. So most of my data, however, I look at it from English because I'm more comfortable with the language, and also I like to get my work published elsewhere. So I tend to use English as my data, but it's not exclusively as such when I do research.
And what about non-verbal cues as well?
We try to incorporate all of this into our analysis as well, because undoubtedly, right, non-verbal cues play a big role in the way we interact and how we interpret meaning from that as well. For example, the way you lean back, and the way your hand gestures are like, your facial expressions, all of this carry meaning.
Non-verbal cues are well documented. You know, when you cross your arms or cross your legs, right, or whatever, you tend to be standoffish, you tend to be reserved. All that is being well documented. But perhaps one area that I want to focus on in this interview is try to see the things that are undocumented. And this moves in directly into the conversation of the BFM interview,
right,
with the CEO of 1MDB then, Arul Kanda. So as mentioned, there are some key areas in that paper that you made. The first one that I want to establish is on what you call vocative.
Right.
Let's understand that better.
So vocatives are names. So we use names, for example, Ibrahim, right? So that is a type of vocative. Now, when you are engaging with someone in a one-to-one interaction, and you were to use a vocative, right, you were to address, okay, Ibrahim, whatever, that can actually indicate some kind of stance that I have towards you. So it's quite important to also look at that, because that tells us very, very quickly, how am I aligned to you? So if I use vocatives can tell me whether or not I treat you as an equal, or I treat you as someone who is not on my level, and how do I react towards that? So by being aware of vocatives, we can actually understand better alignments. So maybe that person is actually not projecting to be friendly, but you know, by the choice of that alignment, by using vocatives, it can indicate something else.
So in this case, Arul used a first name basis with,
with
Julian and with myself, Ibrahim. What does that tell you?
It tells me an establishment of distance. So he positions you guys as, you know, I'm not close to you all. So he asserts power in that sense. So that's one of those key indicators that I could pick up from his choice of vocatives.
Another element that you used in your paper includes selective manipulation of subjects. As you mentioned earlier in this interview, when we pose a yes-no question, he doesn't pick on either yes or no. He moves in a very awkward angle that I've never seen anyone done before.
Right.
How does that work?
In linguistics, so we have this term that's called footing and framing. So it's by a very famous sociologist, actually, who came out with this term. So framing is like a frame, right? The metaphor of a frame. So that means, let's say you have positioned a question, but instead of actually wanting to zoom into that frame, I choose to frame it somewhere else. So that's called framing. And what Aru Khanda does is, he does that on a regular basis, but he gives the impression he's answering the question. Now, I'm not saying that what he's done is wrong, but I'm saying that this is what makes him very skillful.
Yeah, right? I think so, we should clearly establish that, particularly those that are watching this interview. We're not saying that he's right or wrong. We're just trying to understand better how the mind works, right?
Right.
So just now you gave an example of Julian asking yes, no question about either you're guilty or you're innocent.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
But another example that I want to pick on is the fact that we presented a situation where 1MDB changed auditors three times.
Right.
And of the big four, they've dispensed three out of the big four. And the fourth out of the big four, PwC, didn't want to come in.
Right.
Not until the change of government. And we asked him, you know, or not we asked him, we presented the question and we prefaced it in a way where this is wrong.
This is something abnormal, yes.
Abnormal. Nobody changes auditors, right, let alone three times. But his response was very interesting, because perhaps you could pick on that.
Absolutely agree with you. That was quite an interesting way to answer a question, right? What he did was he normalized abnormalities. So that means he would bring in all sorts of normalized examples to counter allegations of what is deemed to be perceived as abnormal.
Okay, let's take to bring some clarity.
Right.
The first auditor switches to the second auditor, and he says that that's normal because before it was TIA or Terengganu
Investment
Authority.
When you change the company,
it's normal for you to change auditors. That's
right.
That's the first normalization. Right. The second normalization is that from the second auditor to the third auditor, he's saying that because of the ability for the third auditor to present bigger partners or express the greater demand,
right, to do
this as a client, so you know it's normal for them to change. So
right,
essentially, it's not three auditors; it's just one auditor changing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his context of normalizing something that is abnormal.
Rather, he brings in what is seen as normal practices elsewhere. So he takes cherry picks these kind of examples to create the impression that it's actually normal. It's everything that is going, that's happening, the changes, they are all normal processes in business. So that is what I would term as normalizing something that is abnormal.
Do you think that things like this needed to be rehearsed first?
I would say that, yes, it does appear that he was prepared with the... I would say that he has probably anticipated this kind of questions, so he was actually quite prepared.
Right. Another element that I want to focus on is on deprecating the interviewers, if I would say. So he used the term. So Julian was asking him a question. His first response was, Julian, you're being very naughty. And in your thesis, you're saying that naughty is being equivalent to childish behavior. And in that sense, he's trying to distance Julian and put him in a place where this is an immature kind of question.
I would say that that's just not... I mean, there are a few ways, because I would say that the projection, right? What makes a professional interviewer? It is someone who has the questions, the right kinds of questions, someone who is objective, impartial, and so on and so forth, right? So these are what makes a professional interviewer. So what happened, there were certain instances where Arul said to Julian and to yourself that he would say things like, okay, you're putting words in my mouth, you're being naughty, what else? And he said to you, what you have said is libelous. So these are things that does not conform or does not meet the expectation of that category of being a professional, right?
Just to clarify, of us, the interviewers, not being professional.
That's right.
Because the interviewee uses these kind of terminologies and presents this kind of context, to a neutral listener or a viewer, they would take it as the interviewers are not prepared, the interviewers are not ready, and therefore these questions should be taken lightly. Therefore, is that the conclusion?
It's more like you guys are not to be taken too seriously. Mm. Yeah, and it had an effect because actually that was something that you guys did not really address and rectify.
Okay, so let's talk about the house style of BFM, because in a footnote there, you said in your statement, you find it rather interesting that the interviewers, i.e. Julian and myself, do not rebut these kind of accusations. Instead, we continue to pursue on our line of argumentation. And in your report, you say that BFM's house style is to chase after the content rather than how the content is being said.
I would say that this is actually quite a common practice in hard talk journalism. It's just not BFM alone, but all over the world where this kind of genre is being practiced. You would have the interviewers very much aligned to wanting to have accurate information. So you are more concerned about the validity of the content rather than what was said about your own character, your own projection of your own identity.
And is this a good idea? Because what does this give off the impression to the watchers, the viewers and the listeners? Do they take it as...
You guys were grilled.
We were grilled. Yeah. That was the conclusion that people would make. Because we didn't dispel these kind of accusations.
Right. That's right.
Is it the same for any other genre? Say, for instance, Stephen Sakur or Zainab Badawi of BBC or whatever, right?
Right.
Is it the same? If an interviewer does the same thing to them at their shows, does that give off that?
It can actually impact. In fact, there are a few studies that I came across where you had... It was a kind of like hard talk interview, right? And these scholars, they actually did a statistical analysis. And they found that those who were not able, the interviewers who were not able to actually counter some of the sort of categories that are projected on the, let's say, unprofessional categories, that actually had an impact on the interviewers.
And negative impact.
Yeah, negative impact. And they were seen as not being professional at the end of the day. Mm. So that can actually have an impact on your own, I would say, career path as well, because it would project you as someone not very reliable, not very trustworthy. You have some kind of partial, beliefs and stuff like that.
Biased, skewed belief.
Right.
All right. Another element that that I want to pick on is putting an end to a line of questioning presented by the interviewer. You briefly touched upon it just now. The example that I want to use is the libel accusation. Right. Arukanda accused me of being libelous. Right. To give context, I was asking him whether or not there was an arms deal transaction between two parties, one involving, say, LTAT and 1MDB. And I was asking him whether or not Tan Sri Loden was involved in a sweetheart deal or an arms length deal. In response, Arukanda said that, Ibrahim, you're bordering on being libelous. And in your notes, I stopped that line of questioning and I pursued on another line of questioning.
Yeah, that's right.
You even mentioned that Ibrahim sounded displeased, but he still stopped and he moved on to another area of discussion.
I did.
Was, you know, 2 years on, I never did see this until I read that passage in your statement. So imagine the unconscious, the unconscious kind of notion that it left me over 2 years until that revelation was made to me.
Can I just latch on to what you just said about that sort of revelation you had? So this is what conversation analysis, the sort of methods that I go through in actually getting this kind of analysis. What we do is we get recorded text. So we start to transcribe sequence by sequence, and then we slow it down. By doing that, we can have our instant replays over and over again to find out which parts actually are interesting to focus on. So that's what we did in the talk in order to find that particular thing that was interesting to us, where he actually accused you of being libelous, and that effectively caught you off guard and stopped you from pursuing that topic further. So at the end of the day, you were not... because the next particular segment in the talk, you were like, okay, so back to square one, you know, and you...
Sort of like a reset button.
You were actually displeased when you said that. So that was why I actually added that as a footnote, because you wanted very clearly to get answers to that question, but you were not getting that because of that libelous statement
that was made. Because of the subconscious fear that he might be right, and therefore I'm like, okay, you know what, I'm just not going to take
it. But what made that actually work for Arukanda was because he had access to privileged information. So that privileged information is state secret, right? So back then, that is, you know, so that means you were making a claim that you were not sure of. You were, in fact, you were presenting it as a H statement, H-E-D-G-A, right? So you were not sure. So you were like, it seems, it appears, maybe. So you were actually trying to get clarification.
So my language, the language or the vocab that I used was already of an unsure statement.
Yes, that's right.
Instead of, I know for a fact that this is
that's
the
right,
case.
That's right. So you were not sure, right? But what happened was Arukanda, he dropped the bomb and he said, I categorically deny what you have said, and it's potentially libelous. So he had that. The reason he was able to do that was because he had that privileged information. He had that connections, whereas you didn't. You were making inferences. So in order to be successful in that, you know, to rebut, you needed to have that evidence and said, wait a minute, I'm not actually being libelous. I have the evidence here and here and that. So if you had that and you were able to present that, then I think that that would actually counter that sort of allegation of you being having some kind of mala fida, that is bad intent, right?
Mm-hmm. Or malicious intent.
Yeah.
In your line of work, what do you call this behavior in terms of what Arukanda did? Is that like characterization or categorization?
We try not to categorize too much, but if I were to refer to some of the principles, okay, one principle comes to mind is the principle of cooperative conversation. So that principle states, if I want to help you, I mean, when we engage in interactions, we tend to help one another, right? So that means when I say something, for example, I think it's really hot here. Your first instinct would be, okay, let me turn on the aircon, right? So that is being cooperating. But I may actually be a little bit more explicit. I may say, I think it's quite hot in here. Could you kindly turn on the aircon? So I'm being more clear, right? So what I'm doing here is I'm actually trying to cooperate with you so that I'm trying to help you understand what I mean. So what Arukanda did in that interview, I mean, that particular segment, he was not cooperating. He recognized that it was a H statement. Well, maybe not, but it was presented, you know, as a H statement. You're not sure, but he presented it as you are being libelous.
Okay.
So he was also able to do that, as I mentioned earlier, was because of the fact he has specialized knowledge of the law. So he understands, you know, this is when the law is applied, how and when. So if you don't have that same kind of access to that sort of discourse, then you are at a disadvantage.
Okay. I think we eventually have to bring this conversation to a close. The whole purpose of me having this discussion with you again, as I prefaced earlier in this conversation or in this interview, is that I'm trying to understand myself better, as well as trying to understand how, you know, a discourse takes place and what can we learn as a regular person out there watching this interview. When we next have a conversation with another person, what would be the two or three things that, if I could just boil it down, that a person could or should do when they go into this kind of discourse and the kind of learnings that they can take from this interview.
Right. So, I would say that Arukanda is a very unique person. This guy is smart and this guy has all sorts of specialized knowledge and he is very comfortable with a sort of genre. So if you don't have that similar level of mastery, perhaps you need to get a group of people, get together, understand his, you know, it's like preparing for the Olympics, right? You want to know how your opponents, what kind of strategies they use. So you study them. Once you study them, you come up with some kind of countermeasures. But I'm not saying that, you know, Arukanda again is a bad guy, but rather these are things, I mean, in fact, I'll be more than happy if he would to actually recognize that and it would probably give him a run for his money, right? So understand how your opponents actually operate. And then from there, come up with your own strategies. And the hard part is actually trying your absolute best to bring yourself to that level that he is or your opponent is actually good at. So that requires a lot of reading, a lot of being informed mainly, so that you're able to actually point out certain things. Another point perhaps you might want to consider also is to ask yourself every time when you're in that in that interview, are you satisfied with the question? I mean, the answer that was provided. If you're not, then you need to stop and go back again. So for example, if you ask a yes, no question, stop. And let's say if the answer was not quite satisfactory, is not answering yes, not answering no, stop and ask, okay, get clarification. So is that a yes? Is that a no? If you're not getting that, proceed until you are satisfied with the answer.
All right. So yes. Slow down.
Slow down the talk. So because in rapid conversation, yeah, it's very easy to lose track of what was said. We tend to be focused on what the other person said, and we tend to forget what was the question asked. So I think by having a clear mind of what your question is trying to get, that would help you to actually navigate the trenches better when you're dealing with people like Arul Kanda.
Did you reach out to him when doing this interview?
No, I didn't.
And was that conscious?
I think it was, because no, it's not really conscious. It's more like it didn't occur to me that I needed to actually approach him, because
And there's no intention on your part to reach out to him?
Not quite. If I were to meet him, I would just say, man, you're really good at what you do.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. This was a very highly interesting conversation. If people want to learn about that particular report or study that you've made, can they have access to it?
Unfortunately, not just yet, because I'm trying to get it published in an edited book. So it's a book that my colleagues and I are working on. It's we have the editor of Routledge interested in trying to get the book published. So it might take about a year or two before that were to appear.
All right. And when it does appear, I'm just going to call you back again and discuss about that.
Sure. I'll be glad to be back.
That was my conversation with Dr. David Yeong of University of Malaya. If you want to watch interviews such as this, just head on to awanireview.com or astrawani.com. Thanks very much for watching, and goodbye.